30-foot-long feathered dinosaur Eutyrannus to the tiny, marvelous spatula-tail hummingbird. Each bird is painted with scientific accuracy, from their physical features to dynamic poses, like swimming waterfowl or a red-faced mouse bird clinging to the side of a tree.
And I think that that kind of gave a lot more life rather than sort of a static field guide depiction of the birds.
The map reflects where each bird lives. That mouse bird clings to the African coastline. The spatula-tail flutters over Peru. A Bermuda petrel sails the open ocean.
It does give a sense of how, no matter where you are, we're so connected by an explosion of diversity of these species.
You can learn more about the Wall of Birds when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Reporting from Abbotsford, BC, this is Danny Nazvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Parallax. The effect by which the position or direction of an object appears to change when the object is seen from different positions. Since June of this year, the Reach Gallery Museum in Abbotsford, BC, has been host to an exhibition titled Parallax, Perspectives on the Canada-US Border. Claimed as being the Reach's most ambitious exhibition to date, Parallax brings together rare archival materials from the historic Northwest Boundary Survey, dated from 1857 to 1862, with new commissions from Indigenous contemporary artists. With these two contrasting perspectives, the goal of this exhibition has been to explore the countless impacts of the 49th parallel on First Nations communities. The international boundary along the 49th parallel was a geopolitical invention by British and U.S. officials, engineers, and surveyors working in indigenous territories in the 19th century. The contributions of indigenous contemporary artists to this exhibition, as stated by The Reach, quote, explored the communities, cultural connections, and ecosystems that were here before and persist today, despite the boundary line's impact on lands, water, and collective imaginations. Offering multiple perspectives on this legacy, Parallax asks us to adjust our vision of the 49th parallel. On November 24th, CJSF was invited for a tour of Parallax, where we were shown the exhibition's various artifacts and contemporary works. What you're now listening to comes from an original vocal composition sung in Hulkamilam by Carrie Lynn Victor, one of the gallery's exhibiting artists. One section of the gallery was dedicated to Toystenat C. Swiss, an artist of Squamish, Stolo, Hawaiian, and Swiss descent. Her part of the exhibition, titled Remembering Kanaka Ranch, is a multimedia reconstruction of her own family's memory of Kanaka Ranch, which existed in what is now Stanley Park and Coal Harbor in Vancouver, BC. Due to her background, the project highlights the long history of Squamish and Hawaiian relations. During the tour, we asked C-Swiss how she wanted her project to be interacted with as one part of Parallax, an exhibition that largely focuses on the history of the 49th parallel.
Yeah, so this time period is happening before the border is put in. And so thinking about that time when people are traveling here, whether they're European settlers or Hawaiian settlers, and then also the indigenous communities coming from their communities on the coast and other places, that they're all kind of traveling through all of these lands that we're all talking about in this time period, and different experiences are happening, and the border in this case hasn't started until maybe halfway, till the last third of the existence. So it was about 40 or 50 years that Kanaka Ranch exists, and when it started there was no border, but by the time it is basically erased, there is a border. So thinking about that time period in all of these places, what is going on in each of those communities? What are the changes that are being imposed on them? And for us, we see the Hawaiians crossing over the ocean to here with no borders and no, you know, understanding of that other than cultural, territorial borders. And those of us indigenous people also recognizing that. And then I think a lot about when it's developing, because I share in here how many Hawaiians and other settlers are coming in, and they're all interacting with the Hawaiian and Squamish communities there. And they're all building stories, and they're all building community, and they're all seeing, they're all reading in the paper, they're reading about when the parallel is coming together, when that border is being built. So I think a lot about, you know, not just the site, but about the changes that they're all going through. And I can do that because I think about my mother's life and when she was born in the 40s until she passes away last year, and I look at everything that changed in her life. So I can use that as a mental visual guide to what it was like for our community members to be witnessing not only the change, because all of a sudden a city is built around them, right? The bridge gets built, then the roads are built, then more buildings. And so all that is happening as they're like erasing Kanaka Ranch and developing it, but they're also developing this border. So all of those conversations, I think there's like a 20-year period where all these changes are happening and people are like just trying to keep up to it all. And I think it was probably overwhelming for some of them. But I think some of them, I think about the notes that my mother left. She wrote a book, which I'm going to get published, and I'm going to use that for the VR experience to help people, as you really stated, and I love that, to put a personal face to those individuals that were part of that change. So I hope that's not too long of an answer, but I feel like it had to be a very layered answer because it's so big.
The tour for this exhibition was given by Kelly Tieliu, the curator of art and visual culture at the Reach Gallery Museum. Once the tour had ended and we had seen all of the artifacts and pieces of art that the exhibit had to offer, we asked Kelly Tieliu what she hopes audiences are able to take away from this exhibition, Parallax.
That's an excellent question. I mean, I think there are many sort of possibilities for different audiences to take away something that is of interest to them. I think for settlers, there is a lot of history that is quite nuanced. Often the history of border demarcation in the 19th century originally is seen as a kind of two-sided story, with the UK and the US coming together to embark on this settler project, and the indigenous voices are often left out of sort of grand historical narrative. And so the exhibition is really an effort to pluralize that history and to really emphasize the multitude of ways in which border demarcation disrupted indigenous territories, lifeways, cultural and spiritual and linguistic practices. So that would be kind of the main important takeaway. But also, you know, as Sandra mentioned at the beginning, it's an exhibition that brings together historic material, photographs and watercolors and maps, along with contemporary work in a wide range of mediums. And so depending on different visitors' interests, there really is something for everyone. Indigenous technology is featured quite heavily, and the materials and practices that go along with that. There are elements of sculpture, there are elements of photography. There's a documentary that is quite long and so we didn't quite get time to spend with. There are kind of more embodied kind of works that invite exploration. So we hope that, you know, different visitors with different interests will find something to engage with.
Parallax, Perspectives on the Canada-US Border, will be available for audiences until May 30th, 2026, at the Reach Gallery Museum in Abbotsford, BC. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Long COVID is a chronic medical condition that can consist of long-term and sometimes debilitating health issues as the result of a previous COVID-19 infection. The Museum of Vancouver's newest exhibit documents the everyday lives of people living with the condition, which, according to Statistics Canada, has now affected up to 1 in 9 Canadians. The exhibition is simply titled Living with Long COVID. For this exhibition, the Museum of Vancouver collaborated with researchers from Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Health Sciences and the Post-COVID-19 Interdisciplinary Clinical Care Network. The exhibition is primarily photography-based, with clusters of pictures and text provided by individuals living with long COVID who agreed to participate in the exhibition. To find out more about what the exhibition entailed, CJSF visited the Museum of Vancouver, where we were able to speak with Viviane Goslin, the museum's curatorial lead. The first question we asked was, how did this exhibition and collaboration with SFU and the Clinical Care Network come to be?
Yeah, so excellent question. I will say that about half our exhibitions are proposed by people, partners, organizations outside the Museum of Vancouver. So so we remember receiving a call from the Faculty of Health Sciences. So Raqib Tesfaye, who's a researcher there, approached us and just called me by saying, we work with long haulers, like so people living with long COVID, and doing research on the subject, and yet working with long haulers, they have told us that they feel invisible and would like to work on something public where they can express themselves and talk about this issue.
Next, we asked what the community response has been like so far for this exhibition on living with long COVID.
I will say for the long haulers, when they come here, and we met quite a few actually on opening day, and the general sense was they were pleased and happy to see themselves, even though they had not necessarily participated in and submitted photos for the project. They saw themselves, they felt heard, felt seen. So that was, that was very positive because that was like one of the goals. The other goal was public awareness, right? Like destigmatize also the topic of long COVID because it is misunderstood. People don't want to talk about it, or people feel judged because people are if they're talking about their symptoms, because there's not a lot of public education on the topic, these individuals feel that like the message they get is it's all in your head. You should try to do some yoga and a bit of exercise and you'll feel better.
We then asked what reactions they received from individuals attending this exhibition that may not have been informed about long COVID beforehand.
There's, members of the public who, you know, really hadn't planned to see an exhibition on long COVID, but just stumbled upon it. And we hear their comments, we do some tracking, and we can see people are surprised. Again, they're surprised by how little they knew about the condition. And also about the severity of the condition. Like the people who submitted, the vast majority are homebound, and their daily life has changed radically since getting COVID and living with the aftermath. And for people in the public health sector, I hope it's going to be a bit of a shakeup, right? Like when museums are partnering with research centers in making this more public, it means that it has to be felt in like daily practitioners, like physicians should know more about it. And also it is underdiagnosed, right? So if practitioners, health practitioners are more attuned, they may be able to refer their patients to specialists and support them in their healing or just kind of stabilizing their condition.
Afterwards, we asked Ghislain if she could go over some of the experiences depicted by those living with long COVID who submitted photos and text for this exhibition.
Part of this project, it's a photo-based project, it's about self-documentation and representation, and we said that part of the constraint, if you want, is document your day, and you can submit one and up to six images for that day, right? And so what strikes me is when people are making reference to their life before, like everything that they were doing, and how, for example, now just going and walking a short walk around the corner or just walking your dog for 15 minutes will completely like drain them. They have to go back to bed, right? So that's struck me, is how their life has been, like kind of their day-to-day life has been, like the life, their universe has shrunk, if I can say it that way. But at the same time, we see great efforts to, figure out how to feel better, document their conditions, like a lot of kind of resourcefulness, and they know that they have this one appointment, and like prepping and researching and trying to understand best they can, like, so a lot of agency in that, like kind of trying to take some control over their condition. And yeah, looking at when I keep seeing like pets, like dogs and cats, I think provides great comfort to people who have them. Like it's something that they mention. It's like, I don't know what I would do if I didn't have, you know, so and so. So I think that presence is, you know, alleviates, if you want, some of the symptoms at times. But we also see these photos where someone made little stars out of like the many pills and supplements they have to take. So a lot of people are showing their bottles of you know, medication and you know, prescribed and not prescribed, and creating their own, you know, cocktail. And again, this is not filtered by a medicalized eye. This is very much the lived experience of long haulers. So we're not saying, hey, this is your treatment. Like for those who, this is them sharing what they're living. And I think whether you're from, you know, like you're a researcher or a scientist or just a member of the public, I think essentially we're asked to bear witness. And you know, if people had not given any thought about this issue, this is the time to think about what that means. And given the high number of Canadians, so 1 out of 9 has experienced long COVID, thinking about our, you know, our friends and neighbors, and like, guaranteed, Danny, that you know people who are living with long COVID. And so how can we help? Is there, you know, how can we support these people?
Lastly, Viviane Gosling left us with what she hopes people are able to take away from the Living with Long COVID exhibition at the Museum of Vancouver.
I'd say come, and I'm in awe with the courage and honesty of long haulers. I, you know, have deep admiration, and yeah, I'm humble, and I hope that people will come, because the more we get to understand the experience of these people, but also the context and the condition, because there's our partners at SFU had, you know, had produced short texts about what is long COVID and what are the symptoms and the kind of impact it has. I think we have a responsibility to educate ourselves.
Once again, that was our conversation with Viviane Gosling, the curatorial lead for the Museum of Vancouver, on the Living with Long COVID exhibition, which is up until March 22nd, 2026. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
A conservation project in eastern Ontario has earned major recognition. Watersheds Canada, a national nonprofit dedicated to protecting Canada's lakes and rivers, took home the Small Project Conservation Award at this year's Water Canada Awards for a winter restoration project on Big Clear Lake in central Frontenac Township. The community-driven project rebuilt a crucial walleye spawning bed, supporting an important native species and a cornerstone of the local fishery. This project is one of 68 completed across 44 bodies of water in central eastern Ontario since the Fish Habitat Program began 12 years ago. I spoke with Melissa Dakers, Habitat and Stewardship Program Manager with Watersheds Canada, about what this award has meant for her and her team and the work behind the project.
It celebrates not just our staff, but all the volunteers, the partners, and Indigenous leaders that we've worked with who make this work possible. It's a national acknowledgement that community-based conservation really works, and it gives everyone involved a lot of encouragement to keep going.
And the winning project was the winter walleye spawning bed restoration project on Big Clear Lake. I was wondering if you could give us a bit of an overview of what that was all about and why it needed to be done.
Yes. So Big Clear Lake, it has a historic walleye spawning bed that had become degraded over some time. We started this project actually in 2023 with our team and volunteers washing the spawning bed with high pressure water pumps and hoses. We scrubbed the rocks with brushes and removed all the algae and silt from the rock substrate. And then the second part of our project was actually supposed to take place the winter of 2024. But if you remember, last winter, it was extremely mild and the ice safety was actually a major concern for us. So we rescheduled it to 2025 to keep everyone safe. And so last winter in February, our team, along with our partners and local volunteers, we restored the site by laying down 17 tons of washed, clean river rock over the frozen lake, right above the spawning bed. And that rock actually creates the perfect spawning habitat for walleye, which are an important native species and a big part of the local ecosystem and fishery. It was cold, hard work, but the results will help keep this lake healthy for years to come. And this project was actually supported by Environment and Climate Change Canada's Environmental Damages Fund, with permits and approvals from the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources and Fisheries and Oceans Canada. And it's one of 68 habitat projects that we've completed through our fish habitat program over the last 12 years.
Wow, 68, geez. And I mean, we've seen a decline in fish habitat across central and eastern Ontario. How does this project and all those other projects you guys are working on kind of help turn the tides?
Projects like this, they not only bring the community together, but what we're trying to do is make people aware of how helping to restore fish habitat can actually change a fishery on a lake. So by also planting your shorelines and reducing erosion so that there's not as much silt on the spawning beds, we can make a really big impact to our fisheries.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of got into this, but I was wondering if you could speak a bit more to how local volunteers and community partners were involved in this project.
Yeah. So honestly, this community was incredible, as are all the communities that we work with. But local volunteers, they brought their snow machines, their ATVs, and a ton of energy out onto a frozen lake to help move and spread the rock amidst a snowstorm. We were also closely working with the Big Clear Lake Association. GE Mattson and Sons Construction were there and donated time. And so were the Shabbat-Obadjuan First Nation. And Chief Doreen Davis even joined us that day. And she called it one of the building blocks of your life, which really captured how meaningful it actually was to have us all there. That shared spirit, people coming together to care for the land and the water, that's what makes these projects so powerful.
Mm-hmm. And moving forward, how can folks in the Kingston region get involved with projects like this and support your initiatives?
Yeah, there's lots of ways that people can get involved. People can visit watersheds.ca to learn about upcoming volunteer opportunities, shoreline restoration projects, or ways to donate to future fish habitat work. We are a nonprofit national charity located in Perth, Ontario, and we raise all our funds through donations, foundations, and grants. So personal donations are really greatly appreciated. And then even small actions at home, like keeping your shoreline natural or reducing runoff by planting native plants on a shoreline, can make a really big difference for water quality and for fish habitat. Every bit of local involvement helps protect the lakes and rivers that we all enjoy.
Once again, that was Melissa Dakers with Watersheds Canada. To learn more about their fish habitat programs, volunteer opportunities, and other ways to support future restoration work, you can visit watersheds.ca. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Is England born a highway? Ich bin Arndt Pildner von Radio Goethe. Ihr hört Mike mit Noise of Corporate right here on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca. Hello, this is Arndt Pildner, host of Radio Goethe. You're listening to Mike and his Noise of Corporate, celebrating the indie noises of the 90s on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca.
Das ist Arbeit.